Art by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. This season's Summerfest benefit celebrates the 105th anniversary of Noel Coward's birth with excerpts from the play Private Lives and a cabaret performance of his songs. For more information about the benefit and the final weeks of the performances of The Glass Menagerie, Guilty Conscience, and Parfumery, visit KrannertCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, featuring a selection of international European cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, and more. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. This is WILL AM 580. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of northern Illinois, effective until 3 o'clock this afternoon. The severe thunderstorm watch includes Ford County in the AM 580 severe weather coverage area. Stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest on the weather. The theme music for The French Chef, starring Julia Child. The program debuted on public television in February 1963. 8 days later, Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, was published. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll take a look at the struggle for the American kitchen. Who reigns, the cook or the food industry? And we'll talk about the connection between the cook and the feminist. Our guest this afternoon, writer Laura Shapiro. She says it took both Friedan and Child to liberate the American kitchen. Shapiro is the author of a fascinating book that looks at the American kitchen in the years following World War II. Laura Shapiro's book is Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. The publisher is Viking. Listeners, you can join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Laura Shapiro was an award-winning writer at Newsweek. She worked at the news magazine for more than 15 years. She's written for many other publications, including the New York Times, Rolling Stone, and Gourmet. In addition to Something from the Oven, Laura Shapiro is the author of Perfection Salad, Women and Cooking at the Turn of the Century. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers if you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon. Laura Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
How interesting to think of this period of history and women's roles in and out of the kitchen. You say homemakers read The Feminine Mystique for the same reason they watched The French Chef. They had been waiting for a long time, and they were hungry. Would you talk about the simultaneous emergence of Julia Child and Betty Friedan and the underlying message both of these women provided other women?
Well, you know, we think of Julia Child as the leader of our cooking revolution, that she brought us out of the dark ages of canned soup casseroles and into the great new world of, brioche and rare lamb and all this. And she did, and she was a wonderful leader. But the fact is, she was never alone, even in 1963 when she went on television. There was a big audience just waiting for her. There had been good French cookbooks in America through the 50s. People were interested. They had started to travel. People were interested in more ambitious home cooking. So there were people who were waiting for this message. And similarly, Betty Friedan, whom we think of as, again, the leader and then the start of the revolution with The Feminine Mystique, she definitely was, an incredibly important voice and force that year, for sure. She got conversations going that had never been held before. There's no question about that. But again, she wasn't alone. She wasn't really the first. There was a crowd of women who had been agitating about these same issues. The McCarthy years had clamped down on a lot of American women's movement organizations. in the 50s, but those ideas were out there so that when the feminine mystique appeared, women could respond to it. As I had written, they were hungry to hear those things. And to the women for whom these ideas were new, both about food and about women's lives, there was just something. It was just like doors and windows all over the house were suddenly flung open. So what I think is that although we think of these two revolutions, the one in the kitchen and the one in sort of life and workplace, as very separate, if not actually opposed to each other, I have always felt that those two women were saying the same thing, and that was they were saying to women, you can do this yourself. You have your future in your own two hands, whether we're talking about what's for dinner tonight or what is ahead for you in terms of working and carving out a life for yourself. You can do it yourself. You don't have to get recipes that were written for the Victorians and are long out of date. You don't have to open cans and jars. You can do this. You are in charge.
Now, were women who were reading Friedan watching Child?
Well, of course, we don't know that, but my feeling is that in a pure demographic sense, the kind of book buyers and people watching what was called educational TV, there probably was a certain amount of overlap there. And in both, certainly in Julia's audience, there were a lot of people who watched because somebody else in the family was watching. You know, Julia Child took pains to make sure that The French Chef appeared at 8 p.m. that first year. It was an evening show. Now, television was full of cooking shows throughout the 50s and into the early 60s. They had sort of local cooking shows with home economists on them, and these were in the daytime. They were aimed at housewives. The whole concept of a housewife was something that Julia Child didn't address. She talked to home cooks. As far as she was concerned, everybody belonged in the kitchen, men, women, children. They should be there. They should be understanding food and seeing how it's prepared. She wanted everybody home in the evening to watch The French Chef. And, you know, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. Free to be you and me in the kitchen.
Yes.
And I suspect this is something that would really please, if she hadn't thought about it, Betty Friedan, you know, that I wonder if Betty Friedan is aware of this connection between the two of them.
Well, Betty Friedan, in her various memoirs and biographies and things, was clear that she was a great entertainer in the years in which she was raising a family and living in and around New York, and writing. She being a successful freelance writer, and then obviously this tremendously effective spokeswoman for the women's movement. During those years, she was a big entertainer. She constantly had parties, and in her books, she writes about the food. Now, I am not sure who cooked it, but the food itself was something of prime importance to her. And she didn't put down women who were good cooks. What she wanted women to do was not make a life of service to one's family in the kitchen by just sort of tradition and obligation, and because you didn't think you were worth doing anything else. That kind of home cooking she was opposed to. The woman who could, you know, go into the kitchen and turn out a good meal for her family and then go up to her studio and paint a picture. Now that was Betty Friedan's kind of home cook.
Yeah. Well, in her book in 1981, The Second Stage, I haven't picked it up for quite some time now, but she wanted to take a more a holistic view of life and women's place in life, I think.
Yes, I like you, I haven't looked at that book in a while, but she did definitely step back. I wouldn't say step back from the principles in the feminine mystique, but sort of stand apart from them and look at a bigger picture. And I think at that time she was very worried that the women's movement was being perceived as being just, this tiny band of hot-headed, man-hating crazies, and which was an image that the media, of course, was very well invested in from the beginning. And she wanted to fight back at that image, and so she aimed a lot of what she was writing at, ordinary middle-class women who either were kind of dismayed at the caricature of the women's movement, or maybe just hadn't dealt with these ideas or thought about them. And she was just trying to present a kind of grassroots, ordinary person view of the women's movement. Mm. And she wasn't wrong to do that, but as always with everything she did, it immediately created temper tantrums everywhere. she's unable to say anything that doesn't get people yelling and screaming.
Our guest this afternoon, writer Laura Shapiro. Her latest book is Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Charleston on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I'm quite certain that Betty Friedan and Julia Child would have known each other because they were both Smith College graduates.
Yes, right. Good point.
All right, thanks.
Oh, thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, other comments, other additions, they're welcome. Join us with a telephone call, 333-WILL, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, Betty Friedan was interested in the problem with no name, and this was something that was out there in the ether. And you write, you know, this was essentially the malaise affecting, and I'm going to quote you now, women who thought they had done all the right things, marrying young, having babies, decorating cakes, and making Halloween costumes. They followed the instructions, the messages in the culture that essentially said, and here we go right to the title of your book, nothing says lovin' like something from the oven. There were a lot of things out there in the culture that were instructing women, you know, giving them the instructions, and women weren't, it wasn't enough.
Exactly. Betty Friedan was absolutely right about that. There was, I'm certain that there was a malaise, and that, and I know from doing research into the culture of the 50s that, that those messages were coming out thick and strong. There's no question about that. What Betty Friedan left out on purpose, because the feminine mystique was it was journalism, really. It wasn't history. It was journalism, and she was arguing a point. What she left out was that the culture was also sending out a lot of messages about working, about finding yourself, about the fact that staying home might not be enough of a life for a lot of women, about the fact that women who were coming of age at that time had some choices. Those messages were in all the same sources that Betty Friedan cites in the Feminine Mystique. They were in the bookshelves in the libraries. They were in the women's magazines. For every article that said, here's how to make the costumes for the Halloween party, and here's how to spend 18 hours decorating the cookies, there were stories about, you know, my child is 5 years old, and I'm eager to get back to work, and I'm looking for childcare, and here's how the women in my community got together and dealt with that problem. There were things like that as well. So issues of work, especially, were very, very prominent in the 50s. People talked about work all the time, and Betty Friedan downplays or ignores that in the Feminine Mystique, as I say, because she was writing to make the other point completely. But when you go back and you look at those magazines, you definitely see it. It was striking to me how much forward-looking thinking there was on the subject of careers and women and jobs and women. You didn't see it translated into anything like agitating for equal pay or dealing with childcare issues or sexual harassment in the workplace. Those things were going to be put off till much, much later. But the idea that women were being raised to work and to earn a living and to look at their lives with a slightly bigger perspective than simply getting married and following in that path, those ideas were out there.
Yeah. And there was also, as you point out in the book, it was delightful to read about Shirley Jackson and the literature of domestic chaos.
Yes, this was a wonderful kind of literary world that was enormously popular in the 50s, and I think it spoke to some of the frustration and the malaise that Betty Friedan talks about. And, you know, for most women who have little kids at home and there's lots to do, and they may not like it, but, you know, they're home raising the children. They're not about to leave them there. So that was their life. And this body of literature sprang up and spoke to that. Shirley Jackson, Betty McDonald, Jean Kerr, these were wonderful. These are some of the best known, and then there were dozens that had a kind of short shelf life or just did one piece in a magazine, but you saw this stuff everywhere, and it was often called nonfiction. In fact, it was sort of fictionalized episodes about family life in which a woman would write in the first person about just sort of adventures at home, things that happened when you raise children and when you run a household. And when the women were good writers, the stuff was often hilarious. And what was interesting to me was how the woman, as the narrator of her own life, had a kind of persona. She would sort of stand back and comment on the action. She was often funny. It was witty. It was wise. It was a little bit cynical. It was a great persona for a housewife, and it had not been seen in literature until that time. And as I say, it was a genre that people just loved, and the women's magazines loved it, and it ran everywhere. Shirley Jackson, who was famous for these kind of grim gothic tales like The Lottery, she also had this other side where she produced these family stories, which were collected in Raising Demons and Life Among the Savages were her two famous collections of those stories, and they're hilarious. If you see them around in a secondhand bookstore or something, they hold up, they are funny. It's a little bit heartbreaking when you read about Shirley Jackson herself. These versions of her family life were a kind of mixture of wistfulness and funny observation and outright fiction. So you see a woman using this kind of literature to work out some of her own issues. But as funny pieces, they hold up and they are funny.
Yeah. And then, of course, at this same time, we had people like Phyllis Diller.
Yes.
And there were, you know, there were other women, you know, in the culture, working women who were also, you know, saying, hey, you know, the grass is greener over the septic tank, kids,
right, yes.
To quote Irma Baumbach's best-selling book.
Right. She was one who, she came along a little later than the time I cover in my book, but and she's the one who has lasted the longest. She really had a wonderful sensibility for exactly that kind of thing, and her perspective, that kind of wry perspective, has been very popular. And the other one that people still remember, I think, is Peg Bracken,
yes.
Who was the one in this genre who wrote, of course, the famous I Hate to Cook cookbook, and that was a huge bestseller, and was followed by I Hate to Housekeep and similar things in that line. And she, one reason those books were popular was that she's very funny. She is really a good writer, and the stuff is hilarious. The other thing is, I Hate to Cook was really a cookbook. It was, she didn't hate to cook. You can tell by the way she wrote about food. What she hated was that feeling that so many women have of just being dominated every single day by the need to turn out these meals and to feed people. And that feeling that, you know, cooking was this ogre that was following you around the house, that you just had to do it. She wanted to dispel that. She wanted to make cooking simpler for people. And she basically wanted them not to be fighting that ogre all the time. So she framed the book in this, in terms of, I hate to cook. We're just going to try and get through this very quickly and put it behind us. But in fact, she has real recipes in there. Some of them are classic 50s collections of packaged foods that would make you, you know, scream and run from the house if you saw them today. But a lot of them were perfectly fine, simple, good old American meals. All the cookies are from scratch. The salad dressing is from scratch. She makes garlic bread. I mean, she makes a lot of perfectly okay food in there. So she's been kind of typecast as this terrible 50s cook. She wasn't. She was a little bit more of a revolutionary than that.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller on a cell phone, line 4. Good afternoon. I don't think the caller is there. Perhaps they'll call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. Food trends change rather quickly, don't they?
In a way, yes, and in a way, no. You know, when the after World War II, when everyone went home and started to make dinner again, and rationing was over, and employment was becoming, of course, very abundant in the post-war years. So incomes were up a little bit, and people were making dinner. They were making exactly what they had made before the war. I mean, the war itself didn't have a big change, and the meals were, they were similar. They were a little, they were smaller meals. They were lighter because people were doing less outdoor work and less farm work, more office work. So their lives were changing like that, and meals were smaller and simpler. But what was on the plate didn't look that different in the late 40s and early 50s from the food that they'd been eating 10 or 20 years earlier. Then, with this huge onslaught from the food industry after the war, which found itself turning out tons of packaged and frozen and canned foods, the same things that they had been using to feed the armed forces, now they're looking for a civilian market for these foods, and they're putting a huge effort into promoting and advertising them, and you are starting to see some of these foods creep into the kitchen, and then you do see some changes, but it was amazing to me how in the course of the 50s food changed more slowly than I thought it would. When I went into this research, I thought I was going to open a women's magazine in the year and for the year 1950 and find, you know, all the sort of silly food that we associate with the 50s, these incredibly fantasy-laden jello salads and things like that, and mushrooms and canned mushrooms and everything, and marshmallows and everything else. In fact, I didn't see so much of that at all. You saw a little of it, but you saw mostly traditional American cooking, and then through the 50s, more ambitious American cooking, more ethnic, more travel-oriented American cooking. And then these 50s things did also creep in, but it was not this dramatic turnaround.
Mm.
Not till really the
60s
and early 70s did you see really a whole lot of that. And then by that time, other trends were moving in. So I think it's more like waves than you know, really fast turnarounds.
Yeah. The food industry post World War II, it wanted to sell America on the instant, the convenient. What were the first products it took to market, and how were those products marketed?
Well, they had, as I say, they had a lot of stuff that literally came right out of their war production
mm-hmm.
effort. I mean, Spam, of course. And then Spam had a number of siblings in the canned meat family with names like Prem and More and Treat. And these were all being promoted. And they had all kinds of dehydrated products and a little thing called Potato Nuts, which was a reconstituted potato product that was guaranteed to hold its shape and supposedly its flavor under any conditions for months. I mean, these were things that had been formulated for the battlefield, and they had a canned Jell-O that was apparently so dense you could be in a foxhole and hold it in your hand and it wouldn't make a dent. The first efforts to market these foods were those things, and needless to say, they didn't go over very well. After a while, the technology improved, and they started putting things on the market that are not too different from what we see today. Frozen foods were the big post-war convenience food advance. These were seen as a big improvement on canned foods because you preserved more of the flavor and texture, and it was just seen as sort of a great new future for American eating, that everything would be frozen. You'd see an end to all the messy inconvenience of fresh foods. People would just float into their kitchens and pull a frozen package out of one wall unit and put it into another wall unit, and a moment later this lovely meal would appear on the table and nobody would have touched any sort of food at all. That really was a vision that appealed to the frozen food industry. Much to their irritation, people didn't buy the stuff. For one thing, it was expensive. For another thing, nobody had freezers. This seemed to be something that just hadn't occurred to them. People did not yet have freezers. And for another thing, you know, people like real food. they like to look at it and touch it and taste it and feel it. I'm sure you see this where you are. Whenever there's a farmer's market opened, people flock to it. They love real food. So that was something that the food industry had to really attack and deal with, you know, very strongly in the post-war years, getting people away from this fixation on real food.
Yeah, yeah. That idea of the future, though, we were drawn to that. I remember watching The Jetsons as a kid, you know, and Jane pushed buttons in the kitchen while George pushed buttons at Spacely Sprockets.
It's true. And, you know, you're right to mention that. The idea of the modern was definitely part of the appeal of some of these new products. I talked to a woman who had grown up in a rural area in the Midwest. She said her mother loved packaged Delmonico potatoes. Now, this woman could have made better scalloped potatoes than anybody, you know, any food company ever. She loved getting these from a box. This was a family that lived far from, you know, movies or any kind of entertainment, and you know, they felt old-fashioned and that they weren't in the modern world, kind of, but this product made them feel like they were in the 50s. They were in the American 50s. They were moving forward. This was something new, and they liked it for that reason. So you're right, that modern sensibility was very appealing.
Mm. And the food industry created some interesting characters to help guide us through these new things, although Betty Crocker goes back to when, the 1930s, maybe?
1921.
1921, okay.
She was born, as it were. And at that time, and through the 20s and 30s and into the 50s, she had a lot of sisters, invented characters that food companies put out as sort of the voice of their company. And if you wrote to, say, Kellogg's, received something, some kind of recipe booklet from Kellogg's, it would be signed by Kay Kellogg, and the person at Pillsbury was Ann Pillsbury. And then, of course, the person at General Mills was Betty Crocker, who was, these people would go out and talk to 4-H groups and clubs and open supermarkets and so forth, and they would be portrayed by home economists who spoke in their name, who worked for the company. But that little painted portrait that you saw on the advertising or in the recipe booklet, that was the person who was supposed to have all the authority and speak so intelligently for the company. In fact, the actual home economists who did the work and knew everything about the product and were really enormously important to the development of the product and to the public relations, the real women home economists got much less attention and authority and were underpaid and everything else. Mm-hmm. These little pen and ink portraits, they were the stars. And it was certainly true in Betty Crocker's career. As a pen and ink portrait, she was enormously influential and the star of General Mills. The real woman behind her who had done the most to build up that character, she wrote the scripts and the ads, and she decided what kind of person Betty Crocker would be and what she would stand for, was an amazing, ambitious woman at General Mills named Marjorie Child Husted, mm-hmm. Very important person there, who was, you know, paid less than the men who did similar work, and she worked all her career for General Mills and ended getting kicked upstairs when she had gotten too much power and kind of put out to pasture. And she was a tremendously important person, and I write about her in the book because I feel like she deserves some recognition for being the power behind the throne of Betty Crocker.
A very smart business person.
Yes, yeah, she saw what was out there. One thing she did with Betty Crocker was she knew that she had a great sense from her own research of how insecure a lot of women felt in the kitchen. They needed advice, and they needed to be able to rely on it completely. She made sure that every word Betty Crocker uttered came from really solid research. Every recipe was tested not only there at the Betty Crocker kitchens at General Mills, but they were sent out to women working in their own ordinary home kitchens to test anything you got in the way of a product or a recipe or something written on the back of the box was going to be absolutely reliable, tested for everything. And And that was the kind of, they called it home service. And General Mills was known for that. They were very smart about it for many decades. And Betty Crocker stood for that. So they were smart. And it was Marjorie Husted who was behind that.
Yeah. And Marjorie Husted, she apparently would go out on the road, and she'd go into communities, and she'd talk to the girls in home ec classes, and she'd send them out to do some research for her, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah, so they would go out, they would wander into somebody's kitchen, they would see women, packing the flour into the cup, and they would report back to Marjorie Husted, well, now you know if you pack the flour in, you're going to get too much flour. You're supposed to heap it in and then level the top with a knife. Well, so Marjorie Husted realized that's a common mistake. She's hearing it from these girls who are reporting back, and she makes sure that all the directions tell exactly how to measure the flour. And sure enough, you know, those are the things that make the difference between a recipe that works and doesn't work. And boy, I certainly know this when I cook. If the recipe doesn't work, A, I throw it across the room and scream, and B, I never use that book again.
Mm, yeah. You know, I want to talk with you about the cake mix.
Cake mix is one of my favorite subjects.
it's been with us now for years, but it wasn't an easy sell.
No, it wasn't. And, you know, I feel even now it's not an easy sell in some ways. I spoke to a group of women in Michigan about cake mixes once, and I asked them to tell me what their experiences were with baking from scratch and with using cake mixes. And it was very clear from their comments and the stories that they stood up to tell that a lot of them felt very guilty about using cake mixes. Even if they had never baked from scratch, they somehow knew that they were doing something wrong by opening a box of cake mix. There's something about that cake mix box that is just, it has guilt written all over it. And that was the first problem in when they invented cake mixes, and they started to come on the market in the late 40s in a big way. That was the perception that the companies had to deal with, was that women would see this kind of instant cake. And in some ways it was appealing because, in fact, it's a tricky business to bake a cake sometimes. In other ways, that cake didn't count. It wasn't something from the oven. It didn't spell love, and it wasn't the real thing. You know, how could you serve that? It didn't count. And so the industry had to counter that perception, and they invented all these strategies. They had an enormous amount invested in cake mixes because the flour companies were not selling home flour in these 100-pound sacks anymore. Ever since women stopped baking bread, they stopped buying tons and tons of flour. So there was a big there were all these strategies for new ways to sell flour, and a cake mix is basically a box of flour with a few things added to it. So that was going to be the new way to sell flour, but women were resisting. They just didn't seem to be glomming onto it, and so they sort of put the full force of their marketing people onto the problem, and they did eventually put them over. But as I say, not completely.
Yeah, yeah. And the products also, the cake mix did improve over time. It became more palatable. But something else happened, as you point out, and that got me to thinking, taking it a further step. You know, middle-class girls growing up after the war in the 50s were more likely to be spending their time after school, you know, outside of the kitchen with piano lessons and television and, you know, on the princess telephone rather than hanging around the kitchen. And then, you know, then I thought, well, you know, those girls became women. Many of them went to work, and their children coming home from school could use the cake mix.
Yeah.
And I think that our tastes might have changed somewhat in that, well, that's what we know.
Yes, I think you're really, you're definitely onto something there. That generational change, gradual, but absolutely there. And starting with the fact that girls in the 50s, many of them did not grow up in the kitchen. They grew up doing other things, so that when they had their own kitchens and their own houses and apartments, it was more of an issue to cook. They were that much more distant from cooking. And then their children were that much more distant themselves. So what you get is an increasingly larger proportion of each generation of people who find a lot of obstacles to cooking. You know, if you cook, that there's nothing difficult about cooking except not knowing how. But more and more we have people who don't know how, and then it seems incredibly difficult, and that's when a cake mix looks like this wonderful solution. And then, as you say, if you've been eating them since your childhood, then you don't have anything to compare them to, and you just don't know the real true magnificence of a cake from scratch. You see, I feel very strongly about this.
Laura Shapiro is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest book, Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, now we have, it seems to me, a number of things going at the moment, I think. We've got this slow food movement going. You mentioned the farmers market. We also have this anti-carb craze thing going. Thoughts on these developments?
Well, what seems to me is that the main thing that has happened in American food is that there's no we anymore. There's no one way of eating that everybody is moving towards. There is craze after craze and movement after movement, but essentially we're a nation of niche markets, and these niche markets are much smaller than, say, a community. They're smaller than a neighborhood. I know families where there are two or three niche markets in the same apartment. I mean, I know a family where the wife is an enthusiastic cook. She doesn't have much time for it, but when she does, she tries all kinds of new recipes. She's very aware of nutrition. She likes to use a lot of vegetables and interesting ethnic ingredients, and that's the kind of cook she is. Her husband is very often the one who's home at dinner time, so he's the one who's in the kitchen putting food on the table several nights a week. He couldn't care less about cooking. He'll pull something out of the freezer. It'll be junk food or fast food or frozen burritos or something else. Those are two niche markets happily married to each other. That's what I think we really have now in this country, so that in many ways it's a better time to be shopping, cooking, and eating than we've ever had. We're more of us have good quality produce within reach. We can get organic ingredients if we want them. We can get free-range chickens if we want them, and these things are more easily available to greater numbers of people than ever before. It's also true, as you know, that we are knee-deep in junk food and fast food, and that we're struggling with this incredible obesity epidemic because our schools are pushing junk food on children. And so the opportunities to either eat really well or eat really horribly are all around us at all times, and it comes right back to what you grow up with, what you see being eaten around you, what the traditions in your own family are, and you know if you raise children, you can't. All you can do is feed them what you feed them at home. Once they're old enough to be out and going to school on their own, they're exposed to the whole world. you can't control that, but you can at least give them a good start. And I know I've tried to do that, and it's not easy. It's not easy making those decisions, but they're decisions that we all have to make. I think that what's happened to American society in the last half century is that we've handed over to the food industry more and more of the decisions about what to eat and when are we hungry and what do we feel like eating and what tastes good to us and what's going to nourish us and comfort us. We let the food industry make those decisions, and that's crazy. They're not out looking for our best interests. They aren't our mother. We have to take those responsibilities back. And that I think is something that kind of rides over the whole last half century.
Yeah. They want to sell us those MREs.
They really do.
Yeah. The big food giants, Pillsbury, General Mills, Kraft. What kind of changes have you seen in their marketing efforts, or have their marketing efforts changed significantly over the course of the last 50 years? Are they just selling us more and more products the same old way?
Well, they're very aware of this niche market business, so a lot of them, they'll have an organic arm and a, you know, plain old junk food arm, and they're, you know, they're covering the waterfront as best they can. I noticed one television ad that I've never forgotten. I saw it maybe a year or two ago, and I forget the product, but it was one of those things that's you're cooking some chicken and you can pour a mixture on it that makes it more interesting, that kind of thing, and so it's a frozen chicken helper, that sort of thing. And it was an ad that showed somebody going into the kitchen and starting to cook this. And then you saw the family assembling, but they were all different ages and races and sizes and shapes. It was just this whole kind of mixed bag living of a family living together in this house. And they all sat at the table and ate this thing that had been made from whatever was being advertised, and the tagline was something like, when you cook your family. In other words, just the fact that you stood at the stove and put two things together over a flame, that act, that was cooking, and that created family life. And I think the food companies are aiming at that. They know that you can't take cooking away. There is something just instinctive and vestigial. People just want to cook. They feel it doesn't count unless it somehow comes from their hands. And so I think food marketing is trying to feed that hunger by taking all the work out of something, but still leaving you something to do, basically. So because they know that it just doesn't feel like dinner at home if you just slap something on the table that had came completely from the outside, and people come and go. That people want something else. They want connection to each other, and they want food that has kind of a human feeling to it. I think when I was at Newsweek, I would occasionally be assigned the story that you've read a million times in every publication, and that is the end of family dinner, why nobody has dinner together anymore. And the editors would assign this story, and I would go out and do the reporting and talk to people who do surveys of this kind of thing and so forth. And it just happened a couple of times I would come back and say, guess what? You guys who live in New York and have these busy lives as magazine editors, maybe you're not having family dinner. But out there in the real world, people are trying, maybe not every night, maybe not a Norman Rockwell spread with a, you know, big beaming family sitting around, you know, and maybe it's 20 minutes and it's a tomato sauce from a jar and the television is on and everything else, but it's a family dinner. People are trying to keep those connections alive.
Yeah. Well, there's a product out there on the shelves that amazes me. It's something like Spaghetti Anytime. And it's like, you know, you can have spaghetti anytime you want. I mean, it's not that hard, you know.
Right.
You know, why do you need something that comes in a plastic envelope? But I guess it's that you take it home and you heat it up. At least you're doing something. And going back to Shirley Jackson, you know, she'd say, oh, if I had time, I would bake a cake mix. But Lord help us if I served frozen popsicles to the guests, you know.
Exactly.
So you do what you can do. And isn't it interesting too that in cooking magazines, I think that the some of the most successful parts of those magazines have to tell you, you know, here's what you can do to get dinner on the table in 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And they say, hey, buy some cookies at the bakery and pick up a loaf of bread. And maybe rip into one of those pre-washed salad things. But but in the meantime, you know, you can put something on the table that tastes good and will keep everybody together until it's time to eat again.
Yes, and you know, it's never been easier to do that. That's the amazing thing. In the time it takes to call for a pizza to be delivered, you can put a piece of fish in the oven. You can open one of these pre-washed salads. You can put some rice on, and you have dinner, and it takes 2 seconds. And if you have time to actually look for a recipe, there are about 8 million cookbooks out. And as you say, they're in every magazine, every newspaper, food section, all over the Internet. 30 minutes is like a long, relaxed cooking time compared to some of these places. Dinner in 10 minutes they'll do. And they're using fresh ingredients and they're decent recipes. These people who write recipes do this all the time now. They know that this is what people want, and we have more recipes like that than anybody will ever make.
Yeah. Well, we've got to wrap up here, but before we go, what are your thoughts on, you know, cooking is entertaining? We've got the Food Network, and we've got a zillion cookbooks, and we've got cooking magazines. And
well, you know, as I say, I think the Food Network, it feeds a hunger. I think it feeds the hunger to cook more than it actually inspires people to cook, although I do know of many people who say that their children watch it and then they want to go and make something that Emeril made. I think it's a little bit inspirational. It's vastly entertaining, and then it feeds a longing. It feeds a longing that, frankly, can't be satisfied by watching television. It can only be satisfied by getting into that kitchen and turning on the stove.
Okay. Well, I'll go home this evening, and my husband and I will make dinner together, and we won't turn on the TV until after dinner.
Great.
Laura Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Laura Shapiro is the author of Something from the Oven, Reinventing Dinner in 1950s America. The publisher is Viking. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, rough day in the soy complex, corn down sharply as well. Beans were off 35 cents in the November contract. December corn for the day finished 7.5 cents lower. Let's begin in the wheat pit where we always do for the day. The high in the nearby September contract at 331, the low at 323.5, settled a half cent above that at 324. It was down 7.25 on the day. December wheat off 7 cents, the high 344, low at 337. Settlement price here at 337.5 for the day. Once again, that December contract down 7 cents in the wheat pit. March contract 355, the high, the low at 347. The March futures in the wheat pit 348.25. Settlement price down 7.5 cents. And the May contract 351, the low for the day, settled on that low. They were down 8 cents, had a high, by the way, of 356. July wheat 359.5, high, low at 354, settled 354.25. Down 5.5 for the day. From the corn pit, the nearby September contract at 231.5 high, low at 225.75, settled closer to the low end, down 7.75 cents. The September's at 225.75 at the end of the day. December futures, 239.75 the high, the low at 233.75, a 6 cent trading range, settled at 234.5, down 7.5 cents. And the March contract, 247.5, the high, the low at 242, settled 242.75, 7.5 cents lower. May beans, or rather May corn, 253.5, the high, the low at 248, settled 248.5, down 7.5. And the July contract, 257.75, the high, the low at 252.25, settlement price there at 252.75, down 7.25. The September futures lost the least amount today. They were down a nickel, 259, the high, the low at 255.25. September corn for next year at 255.25, once again finished the day 5 cents lower. September oats now 131, the high, the low at 126.5, a settlement price at 127.5, down 4.75 on the day. And the December contract 136.75 high, low at 132.75, settled 133.5. They were off 5.25 for the day. Now the soy complex, the trade there sharply lower, down 17.5 cents in the nearby contract. The August had a high today of 731, a low at 706, settled 1.5 above that at 707.5, down 17.5. The bigger losses in the deferred contracts for the new crop. September 654, the high, the low at 624.5, a settlement price at 626.75, off 33.25 for the day. And November being 637, the high, the low at 610, settled 612, and they were off 35. We'll ask Paul Cooley this afternoon during the closing market report why this market decided to go down so sharply today. Very little news, and it may simply be that there was nothing else to trade on, so they moved lower on the bearish ideas that the crop is in very good condition across most of the Midwest. 643, the high in the January contract. Low at 618, a settlement price at 620.5, down 32.5. The March contract, 645 in the bean pit, the high, the low at 624, settled 625, down 32. And May soybean, 649 on the high, the low at 627, settled 628.5, down 26. Bean meal, August contract, 245.50 high, low at 237, settled 237.80, down 670. And the September, 222, the high, the low at 213.50, settled 213.80, down 970. August bean oil, 26.20, the high, the low at 25.30, settled 25.39, they were down 70 for the day. And the September, were off 83, 25.35, the high, the low at 24.40. September bean oil, settled 24.46. Once again, off 83. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A higher day today for cattle. Lean hogs and bellies finish lower. August feeder cattle, 111.97.5 the high, 109.60 the low, 111.92.5 the settlement, that up 277.5. September, 111.20 the high, 108.80 the low, 111.15 the final price, that up 287.5. October, 109.10 the high, 107.20 the low, 109.02.5 the settlement, that up 247.5. August live cattle, 85.37.5 today's high, 83.40 the low, 85.25 the settlement, that up 212.5. October, 87.60 the high, 85.95 the low, 87.12.5 the settlement, that up 157.5. August lean hog, 74.35 the high, 73.57.5 the low, 74 even the settlement, that down 42.5 cents. October, 65.15 the high, 64.30 the low, 64.47.5 the settlement, that down 75. December lean hog, 61.10 the high, 60.70 the low, 60.95 the settlement, that down 27.5. February lean hog, 61.50 the high, 60.60 the low, 61.40 the settlement, that up 55. And July pork bellies, today's high 114.20, the low 111.85, the settlement 112.62.5, that down 120. The Dow is up 4 points at 10,154, the NASDAQ off 23 at 1894, and the S&P 500 down 4 points at 1104.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rick Alber from Santa Monica, California has this poser. Dear Dr. Science, I've noticed that when I tried to install my new hard drive, smoke came out of several components. Is this a problem?
You've got to find some way to get the smoke back inside. Chances are you didn't act quickly enough and the smoke dissipated. Now, if that's the case, you have to procure fresh smoke. A soldering iron can often manufacture smoke if you can't buy the necessary smoke direct from the manufacturer. Ask your Radio Shack sales associate for advice.